The best of enemies is how I've entitled tonight's presentation. Britain and Germany have historically, for centuries, been the very best of friends, even before February 1840, when Queen Victoria married Prince Albert. Britain and Germany enjoyed the closest of ties in friendship, in marriage, in faith, and in culture. Historically, British and German soldiers were the staunchest of allies in multiple wars, in the 30 Years' War, in the 7 Years' War, in all the different conflicts of Europe. Germany and Britain were allies. France and Russia were the mutual enemies, and Germany and Britain were mutual allies. The Great Battle of Waterloo was won by the alliance of British and German troops under the Duke of Wellington and Marshal Blücher against their traditional enemies, the French. In fact, the British have been fighting the French for about a millennium, and they are the standard enemies, always. The Battle of Waterloo, which was one of the most important battles in the history of the world, one of the most pivotal battles, was basically a holding action by Wellington's British troops with Dutch allies while they held the line waiting for Marshal Blücher's men to make the most spectacular forced march in record time, and they managed to come there towards the end of the day and win the battle. The battle could not have been won without both Wellington and Blücher, without both the British and the German forces together. And that's plainly recognized by all. Now, Queen Victoria herself was a descendant of Hanoverian kings and a daughter of a princess of Saxony. Germans, of course. She couldn't have been more German herself. Prince Albert of Saxony was, of course, also thoroughly German. So the British royal family was completely German. The Angles and the Saxons, after whom the Anglo-Saxons are named, came from Germany. You've got the province of Saxony in Germany to this day. It was Prince Albert who introduced the Christian tradition of Germany of Christmas trees to England, and many other traditions too. The cultural exchange from England and Germany to one another during the 19th century was absolutely unrivaled. German composers were the most highly esteemed throughout the British Isles. Beethoven, Bach, Handel, who produced Messiah, Mendelssohn, Schubert, Schumann, Brahms, Haydn, Offenbach, and Wagner. These were the greatest composers in Britain throughout the 19th century, and there's no doubt they were all German. And the Germans, for their side, they read Sherlock Holmes novels with enthusiasm, and they were enthusiastic Gilbert and Sullivan fans. Cricket was introduced to Germany as early as 1850, and by 1914 there were at least 14 cricket teams in Berlin alone. Lawn tennis was introduced from England to Germany by the 1890s, and the Berlin Wannsee Golf Club was opened in 1895. Thomas Cook's very first tourism packages were to Germany, to Austria, and to Switzerland. And by the early 1900s, the English were emulating their German cousins by taking part in hiking tours with such German innovations as rucksacks, alpensocks, and Tyrolean hats. Where does the name rucksack come from? There's so much of the German culture interwoven with the English. The fashion for dressing children in sailor suits originated in the 1840s when Queen Victoria began dressing her sons in naval costumes. And this soon spread throughout all the European royal families, Germany, Austria, Russia, they all did it. The Great Exhibition, the first great trade convention in history, held in 1851, was organized by Prince Albert in Hyde Park. And not only were British industrial products put on display, but there were more than 1,500 exhibitors from Germany. No other nation, aside from Britain, the host, had as many exhibitors as Germany. You might notice the design that Prince Albert had for the Great Exhibition for this Crystal Cathedral was to accommodate the great trees, the oak trees in Hyde Park. He didn't want to chop them down, so he accommodated them. And that's what our Victorian Alfred Basin shopping centre at the waterfront is designed on too. It's based on the same design from Prince Albert from the Crystal Cathedral at the first Great Exhibition. Throughout the 1800s, a torrent of German inventions and manufactured goods flowed into Britain. Germany was Britain's main source of imports, and Germany was the most receptive overseas market to English goods. British homes were filled with Dresden china and Leica cameras. I remember my father had a Leica camera, and Voigtlanger cameras, and Zeiss binoculars. and Adler and Olympia typewriters, and fluorescent lamps and the Geiger counter produced by Hans Geiger, and radio waves, X-rays, all of these were German discoveries which dominated the British markets. Over 100,000 British children went to bed with teddy bears made by Steiff after having played with the German-made train sets or China dolls. Germany provided British manufacturers with the most profitable market. Almost every German home used Oxford marmalade, an English mustard and golden syrup, and Sheffield cutlery, and Wedgwood china. Many of the trains and steamships in Germany were built in Britain. Germany dominated the optical industry, and it was particularly the Austrian Johann Voigtlanger whose cameras and lenses dominated the market, both for glasses, monocles, all the way through to cameras. And Voigtlanger, by the way, was the one who introduced the English fashion of wearing monocles to Austrian Germany. Now, the way the Hollywood portrayed it in later years, you would have thought that the monocle was a uniquely German practice, and they would generally depict the German or the Prussian enemy as wearing a monocle. But the monocle was an English tradition which had been introduced to Europe by Voigtlanger himself. Many German names are so familiar in Britain that they're almost considered indigenous. Now, all of these are German names and German manufacturers which you probably thought were totally indigenous in England, like Nivea face cream and Osram light bulbs and Agfa film and aspirin from Bayer, Bayer being one of the provinces of Germany, Bavaria, Persil washing powder, AEG stands for Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, BASF stands for Baden-Anline Soda Factory. Emil Berliner invented the microphone in 1885, and in 1887 he invented the gramophone, which completely dominated the British markets. You've all seen this picture before, I'm sure. Rudolf Diesel was a German who invented the engine that bears his name, the diesel engine. And the diesel engine is what powered the British Navy. Here's a German postage stamp remembering Rudolf Diesel. And Siemens. In the 1850s, William Siemens opened the British branch of the Siemens Electrical Engineering Company, and Siemens manufactured the telegraph and telephone cables. Here's the different cables that Siemens manufactured. And Siemens laid the thousands of miles of undersea telegraph and telephone cables, which made Britain the hub of a global empire and London the center of international finances. Julius Ritter was another German who set up an office in the stock exchange and founded the organization that added news and information to this cable network. What about the kindergarten? Even the way how you spell it should remind us that this is a German innovation. From 1851, many of the British children were spending the day attending a new type of elementary school imported from Germany, the kindergarten. The idea was to grow children in a children's garden. Friedrich Froebel, a Lutheran, had introduced the kindergarten system to Germany in 1837 and came to Britain in 1851. At the first international chess tournament organized in London in 1851, at the same time as the Great Exhibition, the British were shocked when their top chess champion, Howard Stoughton, whose name is given to the designer of the modern chess set, the man on the left, he is beaten by the German competitor Adolf Anderson. And this created an international rivalry. Many noted that the seeds of the later rivalry between Great Britain and Germany were sown in 1851 when British manufacturers realized what major competition they had from German industry and when the chess champion could be beaten. See, by 1914, Germany was outstripping England in industrial production, and there was a very real chance that Germany's navy could challenge the Royal Navy, which to Britain was anathema. However, nobody in the 19th century would have ever predicted war between Britain and Germany. It would have been absolutely unthinkable. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert spoke almost exclusively German to one another. Now, that would be a shock to most English people to realize that. But Victoria and Albert, in their own home, only spoke German to one another. Their family was brought up speaking both German and English. Princess Victoria, the daughter of second English queen, was the wife of the Crown Prince Frederick Wilhelm of Germany, who is the father of the Kaiser at the time of the First World War. So Queen Victoria was the grandmother of most of the royal families of Europe, including of the Kaiser that King George V went to war against, which was his cousin. As late as December 1898, when war between Britain and France was a distinct possibility, Kaiser Wilhelm II assured the British ambassador that if England were ever in serious danger, Germany would certainly come to assistance. Europe was not conceivable without England, he said. Germany and Britain were the best of friends right up to the end of the 19th century. In 1890, an English newspaper interviewed Chancellor Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor, who noted that war between England and Germany was wildly improbable. Hard for us to imagine from this perspective, because we've now had how many Hollywood films and two world wars, but it was absolutely unthinkable before 1914. The British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, in 1912 predicted that any differences between Germany and Britain would never assume dangerous proportions. Never. Even as late as August 1914, the month that the First World War was declared, the British ambassador to Berlin, Sir Edward Goschen, described British relations with Germany as more friendly and cordial than they had been in years. Politically, diplomatically, militarily, Germany and Britain were closer than any other two nations on the planet. We're used to the Americans and the British speaking about a special relationship between Britain and America. Well, in the previous century, they would have said that only about Germany and England. There was no two nations on the planet closer together than Germany and Great Britain in the 19th century, when Queen Victoria was queen. Throughout the 19th century, war between Britain and Germany was absolutely inconceivable. Throughout the 19th century, the British and German people cherished their special relationship based on a common heritage, common kinship, common blood, and a common Protestant faith. But tragically, generations of friendship and mutual respect was shattered as the heir to the Austrian throne was assassinated. This is the fateful day in July 1914 in Sarajevo, as Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie came for a state visit to Sarajevo, and they were shot and assassinated by this 18-year-old Bosnian Serb student in Sarajevo with this pistol. This was not the first attempt on his life that day. They'd thrown a bomb at him earlier that day, and it had bounced off the vehicle and exploded harmlessly, and he continued the procession, which today's Secret Service agents would never do. There's one attempt that pull you off the route, but he continued and was shot. Both Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie, both murdered July 1914. And here's Franz Princip being arrested. How did that terrorist act in Sarajevo sever the special relationship between Britain and Germany that had endured for centuries? Now, it's understandable that Austria was going to do something about that troublesome neighbor, Serbia. Serbia had sponsored and encouraged and hosted revolutionaries and terrorists against the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Here's a backstabbing attempt by another assassin who tried to kill Franz Ferdinand on an early occasion, which was foiled. There'd been numerous attempts on his life, and Serbia was the host of most of these terrorist attacks. So obviously Austria was going to deal with Serbia. However, as Austria gave an ultimatum to Serbia, the Russian Empire mobilized against Austria and guaranteed full support to Serbia. This led to Germany mobilizing in support of its Austrian ally against Russia. Now, the French were allied to Russia and were spoiling for a fight to reverse the humiliating military defeat that they had suffered at the hands of Germany in 1870. At that stage, it was Louis Napoleon, Napoleon III, who declared war on Germany over an absolutely insignificant little episode on the Spanish succession, where Germany sponsored one candidate and then withdrew when France got upset. But that wasn't enough. France then decided to declare war on Germany, and they got absolutely flattened. They had no idea how efficient the Prussian army was. And in 1870, at Versailles, after defeating France in the most humiliating military defeat France had ever experienced, they declared the German Empire. Because up to then, there'd been a Prussian Empire. There's the German states, and Thierry United under one Kaiser in 1870 on France's territory in the Palace at Versailles after this great victory over Napoleon III, Napoleon Bonaparte's last reigning descendant. His son, by the way, died in Zululand at the hands of the Zulus during the Anglo-Zulu War. That's another story. So the French were spoiling for a fight. Now, strangely, King Edward VII had allied Britain to France and Russia, probably out of spite for his parents, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. Prince Albert was a staunch Lutheran disciplinarian with strong work ethic, very evangelical, very Protestant, and he tried to instill in his children a strong faith. Now, Edward, who, by the way, was named Albert, but he rejected his father's name when he became king. He took the name Edward instead of Albert, which was the name of his father. He should have been King Albert I, but that's how much he hated his father. He wouldn't even use his father's name. Edward VII, as we know him, was a lazy son. He didn't have his parents' work ethic. He despised his parents' faith. He was not the dedicated Christian that his parents were. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert were dedicated evangelical Christians. Edward was a whoremongering, immoral reprobate. And he loved the brothels of Paris. And he signed the Triple Entente, linking Britain's future with France and with Russia while on a drunken orgy in the brothels of France in 1904. And this alone took Britain from a path of always being Germany's ally and France's enemy to where it was locked in its fortunes to a Catholic and humanistic, and in the case of Russia, Orthodox heritage against its Protestant kith and kin. Edward was a very spiteful man. He was so uncouth as to carry on an open affair while married. And his mistress would travel around at state events, and there was nothing secret around. The Edwardian years was a reaction to the Victorian years. Victorian era was duty, honor, family, country. Edwardian was eat, drink, be merry, shoot as many geese as you can, that kind of thing, get drunk. Edward was quite outrageous. His son, George the Fifth, brought England back to more of the Victorian era standards. And then Edward the Eighth was going back on Edward the Seventh style, and he's the one who abdicated rather than give up this divorcee that he was having an affair with, broke up a marriage and gave up his kingdom for an illegitimate relationship. So if somebody wants to say that morals don't matter, here's a case where I believe the greatest catastrophe in history of civilization took place primarily because of one reprobate, rebellious son's immoral spitefulness and hatred for the heritage of his parents. And so Britain ended up on the side of its traditional enemies, France and Russia, against its traditionally closest ally, Germany. And there's no good logical reason aside from Edward's spite. So, this is how it unravels. Austria deals with Serbia. Russia comes to the support of Serbia. Germany defends Austria-Hungary. So France defends Russia. So Germany, to reach Paris, has to go through Belgium. And so Britain decides to come in on the side of Belgium, France, and Russia. And hey presto, the House of Cards comes down so fast it makes your head spin. On the 4th of August 1914, as Europe began mobilizing for the most disastrous war in history, Britain's first act of war was not military, but aimed at communication. The steam cable vessel Talconia was anchored in the North Sea under cover of darkness to trawl for cables on the seabed. And by dawn, engineers had located and cut all five German cables to France, Spain, Tenerife, which is one of the islands in the Atlantic, and two cables to New York, severing the cord of communication from Germany with the North American continent and with Britain itself. And the severing of these transatlantic cables heralded the beginning of a war of words before the first shot had been fired. The deep wounds inflicted by the propaganda war would last far beyond the ending of the First World War and created a climate of mistrust and suspicion that poisoned Anglo-German relations for over a generation. Cutting the transatlantic cables also signaled the start of a new kind of war, a war of propaganda. The first time in history such a war would be fought, at least on these scales. It cut the ties that had bound Germany and Britain closer than any other two nations on earth for over 100 years. The torrent of lies and deceit unleashed by the clandestine public relations campaigns continues to inspire hate and prejudice in Hollywood films to this very day. Under Lloyd George, a secret British propaganda agency was set up which secretly enlisted the active support of virtually every great British writer then alive, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote Sherlock Holmes' books, for example, Arnold Bennett, John Buckham, John Masefield, G.K. Chesterton, famous Catholic conservative, Thomas Hardy, Rudyard Kipling, probably the most vitriolic advocate of war, and he more than anybody promoted the First World War. And H.G. Wells, who was an anti-Christian atheist who wrote War of the Worlds and many other books. But their pens were now dipped in the poison of lies and directed against their recent close friends and relatives in Germany. The British military intelligence not only mobilized the literary big guns for its propaganda campaigns, but they manufactured the most outrageous atrocity stories to attribute to their new enemies. The legacy of bitterness and disillusionment created by this clandestine propaganda war had far-reaching, devastating consequences for world history throughout the 20th century, including the loss of the British Empire, including the decolonization of Africa ahead of schedule and with nothing but Soviet red Chinese and Americans to fill in the vacuum as the European protectors of Africa withdrew. A lot of things went wrong as a result of this clandestine propaganda war. In 1914, Christian nations ruled the world. With the exception of China and the Ottoman Empire, Christian nations, either Orthodox, Catholic or Protestant, ruled the world. And the world was better off for it, actually. And the world in 1914 was so safe that burglar bars would have been unheard of and unthought of, and so much else that we take for granted today. And the world was being evangelized and discipled. And 64% of Europe went to church every Sunday. By the Second World War, it was down to 40%. After the Second World War, it plummeted to 4%. That's roughly where it is now, 4, 5, 6% around Europe. That's some places as low as 2% church attendance. Europe has gone from being the greatest missionary sending continent on the planet, the greatest force for evangelizing, discipling the world, the greatest force for civilization, the greatest force for literacy worldwide, into a mission field itself. In one generation, two world wars destroyed the missionary sending heart of the Christian church, and the consequence have been devastating for the whole world. David Lloyd George was the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the beginning of the war. Later he became British Prime Minister, but at this stage he is Chancellor of the Exchequer, which would be the same thing as Minister of Finance. He was one of the first politicians to understand how the media game is played, and he shamelessly exploited the press for personal and professional advantage. This had never been done before. In 1911, Lloyd George had championed the National Insurance Act, an important foundation stone for the welfare state, for socialism actually. To push this highly controversial act through against very strong resistance, Lloyd George sponsored media manipulation to mobilize public opinion, with everything from cartoons to editorials. It was probably the first time that a modern, democratically elected government had spent public money setting up an organization specifically designed to manipulate public opinion. Now, the government's meant to represent the interests of the people. For the first time now, government's going to try and manipulate people to change the way they think about things in order to fit in with government's plans. So instead of the government reflecting the concerns of the citizens, they're wanting to mold the citizens to reflect the concerns of government. It's a very important distinction. The National Insurance Commission set up by Lloyd George was the first government public relations machine ever producing newspaper articles, pamphlets, and nationwide lectures, all in favor of legislation. Before, it was left up to the free marketplace of ideas to discuss the merits or demerits of campaign. Now the government's putting your taxpayers' money into brainwashing you. Dangerous. Lloyd George, as appointed leader of this commission, was a fellow Liberal Member of Parliament and a journalist, Charles Masterson. Masterman. So it was in 1914 that Lloyd George turned again to Charles Masterman to set up the British War Propaganda Bureau based in Wellington House in London. On the 2nd of September, Masterman invited Britain's top literary talent to a secret meeting at Wellington House. It was a who's who of British authors. The authors were requested to produce books, articles, pamphlets promoting British war aims. The Bureau would arrange to have these books published through normal commercial printing houses, Oxford University Press, Thomas Nelson, Hoddenstotten, Macmillan, Cambridge University Press, and they would guarantee financial success. Now, one thing every author needs is a publisher. The Bureau guarantees your books will get published. Just promote the British war aims, you'll be guaranteed financial success. And these well-known authors were also requested to sign a full-page advertisement, which the Bureau had drawn up, to appear in New York newspapers denouncing Germany and appealing for American support. Brilliant. All of these would be secretly financed by Wellington House. This clandestine disinformation operation was so effective that it was only by 1935 that the existence of the War Propaganda Bureau even became known. That's how effectively it was kept a secret. And Rudyard Kipling was the linchpin who made this work. John Buckham, author of espionage tales like The 39 Steps, which Britain has made who knows how many movie versions of, he's also director of Thomas Nelson Publishing House, and he ended up as director of Ministry of Information, so how's that for conflict of interests? The 11th of September 1914, Masterman held a meeting with all the editors of the leading newspapers and formed the Neutral Press Committee. How do you like the name? Neutral Press Committee. To ensure that all British newspapers towed the party line, advanced British war aims, and disseminated British propaganda overseas. It was brilliant. In May 1915, the British War Propaganda Bureau produced a notorious report on alleged German outrages. Now, this report was reported to be an independent and objective official review under the chairmanship of Viscount Bryce. He is the former British ambassador to the United States, chosen for good reason because he's popular in the United States. And he knew the American mentality. It was, in fact, nothing but a piece of black propaganda loaded with fictitious outrages, atrocities, and absolutely outrageous lies. Yet many of its claims, such as the bayoneting of babies, raping of nuns, chopping off of children's hands and feet in Belgium, end up in school history textbooks. And Lloyd George admitted in Parliament, we know that not one of these things ever happened. And I've picked up history books today published in the last couple of years still repeating these lies, which are nothing but fictitious black propaganda made at the time of the war. The British War Propaganda Bureau produced over 1,100 pamphlets and a vast number of books, including To Arms by Arthur Conan Doyle, The Barbarism in Berlin by G.K. Chesterton, The New Army by Rudyard Kipling, The Two Maps of Europe by Hilaire Belloc, Liberty, a Statement of the British Case, and War Scenes on the Western Front by Arnold Bennett, Is England Apathetic by Gilbert Parker, and Gallipoli and the Old Front Line by John Masefield, A Sheaf, Another Sheaf by John Galsworthy. H.G. Wells produced The Research Magnificent, and Mr. Britling Sees It Through. Most memorably, H.G. Wells produced The War That Will End War, which became the catchphrase for the Americans as well, and Wilson took this as his own, that this is the war to end all wars. John Buchan produced the flag-waving propaganda, the Battle of Jutland and the Battle of the Somme, and turned these two defeats into victories. Buchan's greatest hit was his espionage adventure, The 39 Steps, and this book helped to generate spy mania throughout Britain, and Buchan followed it up in 1916 with Greenmantle. All of these were runaway bestsellers, successes, as it was inevitable it would be. The newspapers are promoting them, everyone's promoting it, it all looks spontaneous. An example of the distortions published by Buckham was his Illustrated History of the War, published in 1915, which claimed that the Germans were on the verge of defeat, having lost 1.3 million soldiers compared to less than 100,000 British lives lost. Now that was such a lie. The British army had lost 1/3 of all their men in the first year. 1/3 of all British soldiers were killed in the first few months of the war. And they kept, that's why they had to keep recruiting more, hundreds of thousands and millions more, because they were losing men by the hundreds of thousands. In the Battle of the Somme in 1916, Britain lost 650,000 men in a four-month battle, and they gained 4 miles of territory. It was such a disgrace. It was the blackest day in British military history. They lost 65,000 men in the first day of the battle. And they knew even before the day had begun that it was a failure. And yet they went ahead. They just had the men go over the top. What they'd done is they'd decided to concentrate the greatest artillery barrage in history on the area of the Somme. And they planted tons of high explosive on every square meter of the area. And they told the soldiers, when you get up, you can slope arms, you can sling your arms and walk. There'll be no barbed wire, there'll be no Germans for miles. You can just walk and occupy territory because the artillery will have cleared the way. But when the day dawned after 11 days of bombardment, everyone could see the barbed wire's unaffected, the barbed wire's still there, and the German army was in their positions in the concrete bunkers underneath while the bombardment went on. When the bombardment stopped, they knew, attack's about to take place. They got up there and they put up signs in English, "Come along, Tommies, we're ready for you." And the generals knew this is going to be a failure. They're putting up the machine guns. We have failed to clear, and they still got the men to go over the top. And they got wiped out. 65,000 men lost in the first day. And they carried on for 4 months, just pouring them across, and they just got wiped out. It was 650,000 men killed in 1 4-month battle in one area. Britain lost more men in the Battle of the Somme than they lost in the whole of the Second World War on all fronts combined. That's how bad it was. And Buchan and Rudyard Kipling, who were getting the reports and they knew exactly what was going on, were just publishing lie after lie to encourage more people to go out there and volunteer for this glorious victory, which they all knew they didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of getting. It was a stalemate on the Western Front. Nobody could win. Arthur Conan Doyle brought the world's most famous detective out of retirement to turn Sherlock Holmes' deductive powers into trapping von Bork, a fictitious German spy in England. Because the press was in on the deception, the public and most of the members of the British government remained in the dark and accepted the ever-growing torrent of anti-German literature as spontaneous expressions of journalists, authors and historians. And it was as coordinated as it could be. Now in response, the German Foreign Office set up and funded the Central Office for Foreign Services under the direction of Matthias Erzberger, the leader of the Catholic Centre Party. Here's a picture of Battle of Tannenberg, a whole lot of Russians surrendering. In fact, two Russian armies were destroyed by General Hindenburg, later Marshal Hindenburg. The Foreign Services Office was primarily concerned with collecting and studying printed works from abroad to analyze what the outside is saying. And later they published German newspapers and magazines for distribution abroad, including the Continental Times, Kriegschronik, War Chronicle, and the Great War in Pictures. Each photograph was captioned in up to 6 languages, including English, and also the weekly illustrated War Courier. The German Foreign Services Office was especially keen publishing photographs. They're very photo-heavy, because visual propaganda needs no translation, and pictures could touch the emotions directly and present evidence of their case. And so instead of having a lot of text which needs to be translated in multiple languages, they just went for the pictures and nice stories like the air ace Immelmann and his dog and so on. And later in the war they would also distribute films. In Berlin, the German writers and journalists and artists were encouraged to extol German courage, self-sacrifice, military prowess, and they focused on heroes such as Baron von Richthofen, and to expose English treachery and cowardice and failure. So standard propaganda, show up the bad of the other side and the good on your side. I mean, that's what all propaganda really is. The propaganda machines in Britain and Germany aimed to demoralize the enemy forces and the civilian populations by damaging press reports and by dropping leaflets from the air. Now, aside from bolstering their own populations with positive propaganda, the Bureau targeted the enemy population for negative propaganda. You always have propaganda own forces to build up and propaganda enemy forces to break down enemy forces' propaganda. That's pretty standard today. The anti-German pamphlets, leaflets, and newspapers were distributed in Germany and Austria not only by air, but they had another way. Not only did aircraft and balloons drop propaganda leaflets over German areas, but propaganda was directly posted to selected addresses through enemy mails. They would go through neutral countries and mail their propaganda leaflets in German, in envelopes that people would receive, and they'd wonder, you know, is this true? And you'd sort of start rumors and try to undermine the morale of the other side. And they forged German, Austrian postage stamps. They did the same in the Second World War. Now, along with the British Navy's starvation blockade of Germany came a moral blockade through propaganda in neutral countries to try and turn neutral countries against Germany by propaganda. The German general Erich Ludendorff wrote in his post-war memoirs, "We were hypnotized by the enemy propaganda. As a rabbit is by a snake, it was exceptionally clever. It was conceived on a grand scale. It worked by strong mass suggestion. It kept in the closest touch with the military situation and was unscrupulous as to the means it used." Now, aside from breaking down enemy morale, you want to build up your own forces' morale. So propaganda always aimed to inspire their own civilian populations to gain moral support for the war, inspiring young men to enlist and fight, and encouraging greater industrial and agricultural production. Farmers, workers, everything you do is helping for the war effort, it's essential. Come into our factories, produce more weapons, and so on. Now, the third goal of these propaganda partners was to gain the support of neutral countries. In this respect, both Britain and Germany had the same primary propaganda target, and that was the United States of America. Germany's goal was to persuade the US to remain neutral, and Britain's goal was to persuade the USA to be militarily involved on the Allies' side. Now, the sinking of the Lusitania is the pivotal propaganda event of the First World War. It makes every history book. From an American point of view, the most dramatic event leading to the US entry into World War I was the sinking of the RMS Lusitania on the 7th of May 1915. On the 4th of February 1915, the German government had announced that in retaliation for the British Navy's blockade of German ports, the Kriegsmarine was going to launch a counter-blockade against the British Isles using submarine warfare. Nobody could challenge the Royal Navy on the surface, but we've got a new weapon, we're going to go under the surface. First war in history, the submarine warfare became a major factor. From 18th of February onwards, every enemy merchant vessel in the water surrounding the British Isles would be targeted. Neutral vessels were warned that they could be exposed to danger in this war zone in view of the misuse of neutral flags, which was ordered by the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, on the 31st of January, where he told the British to use neutral flags to persuade, in fact, the submarines to come to the surface when they could be destroyed. So Sir Winston Churchill had encouraged merchant vessels to fly the flags of neutral countries. Naval personnel were also urged to wear civilian clothing to lure German submarines to the surface where they could be vulnerable to being destroyed by concealed surface guns. Winston Churchill declared that the Royal Navy blockade of Germany was meant to starve the whole population. Men, women and children, old and young, wounded and sound, starve them all into submission. And that you get from his own book on the war. In addition to the Royal Navy's battleships and cruisers, the British mined vast sections of the North Sea to imperil even neutral ships that might be trading cargo with the enemy. Basically, the war was not won in the front lines. The war was won by supply or blockade. Historian John Coogan noted, "By sowing mines in international waters, Britain deliberately replaced the belligerent's right of visit and search in the North Sea with a new rule, explode and sink." The Geneva Conventions allowed for a blockade from a close area to prevent weapons reaching. But no treaties of war had ever recognized that you could prevent food entering on the high seas. It was weapons alone. And now instead of that, you could search the vessels, see if they've got weapons, now you can explode and sink them. And this is completely contrary to international law. So up till the First World War, food intended for civilian use was never considered contraband by anyone. This is the first time in history food is considered contraband. And this is a plain violation of international law. However, the American president, Woodrow Wilson, refused to draw any connection between the German warning of submarine warfare and the British hunger blockade of Germany, using both surface fleets and sea mines. So on the 29th of March, 1915, the British steamship, the Falva, was sunk by a German U-boat, and according to British propaganda, the German captain had fired without warning, killing 110 people, including one American. But investigations later established that the German captain had given the Falva three warnings, had fired only after the British warship had appeared on the horizon, and the Falva was carrying 13 tons of ammunition anyway. Nevertheless, President Wilson sent a warning to the German government that the United States would protect American citizens even if they were sailing on ships belonging to belligerents, even if they were involved in open war. This was a dramatic change in policy. During previous wars, for example, during the Japanese-Russian War of 1905, the American government warned its citizens they traveled to war zones at their own risk. The RMS Lusitania, the Cunard Line, was known to be carrying thousands of cases of ammunition for the British Army. The German government published warnings in major American newspapers not to book passage on the Lusitania, cautioning American travelers that the waters around the British Isles were a war zone. Those traveling on ships of Great Britain and the Allies did so at great risk. Documents which had been sealed for 60 years were only released in 1975, detailing how First Lord the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, had conspired to bring about the sinking of the Lusitania in order to enable the American government to convince the isolationist population of the need for America to enter the war on Britain's side. This was so explosive, it didn't have the normal 20 years sealing, didn't have 30 years, it had 60 years before the documents could come out, and it's explosive. I remember reading this back in 1975 as a young boy in Rhodesia, and that was one of the first books that shook my conviction that Hollywood's version is not always right. Radio signals from the Admiralty even instruct the Lusitania to change course and deliberately led it to known location of German U-boats. And U-20 Captain Walter Schweiger fired a single torpedo in order to give the passengers and crew of the ship sufficient time to lower the lifeboats and to abandon ship. He was stunned to see the tremendous explosion caused by a single torpedo. And the vast cargo of ammunition had clearly been ignited from that single torpedo, and the ship sunk in minutes. Now think, for example, that the Titanic was ripped the length of a football field by ice, under the waterline, and water poured in. And it took over 2 hours for the Titanic to sink. The Lusitania wasn't much smaller than the Titanic, and this sank within 20 minutes. What's the difference? Little hole from a torpedo, that wouldn't make it sink that fast. It was the ammunition that exploded inside. That's what caused it. And it's been well documented since. Massive amounts of ammunition. In fact, the Lusitania wreck site, when there was attempts recently to try and explore it, the British Navy went and did depth charge training and blew up the whole thing. And said, they forgot that the Lusitania was down there. It was just a routine training exercise. 1,195 of the ship's 1,959 passengers perished, including over 100 of the Americans on board. The sinking of the Lusitania was fully exploited by the propaganda bureaus of Britain and of the United States. But the American Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, reminded the President that the investigation confirmed that over 5,000 cases of ammunition and shells had been on board the liner, and that the German government had repeatedly offered to end submarine warfare in exchange for the elimination of the starvation blockade of Germany. Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan challenged Wilson's double standards. He said, "Why be shocked at the drowning of a few people if there's to be no objection to starving an entire nation?" The German government suspended their submarine operations, but Woodrow Wilson demanded that American ships had the right to travel on armed, belligerent merchant ships carrying ammunition of war through a declared war zone to Britain without the right of the German Navy to interfere with us. Convinced that he is part of an administration hell-bent on war, Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan resigned. Although Woodrow Wilson spoke of submarine warfare as a war against mankind, historian Thomas Fleming points out that the United States Navy adopted the very same policy as the German Navy during World War II. The US Navy launched more submarines than Germany in the Second World War, did you know that? And throughout its involvement in World War II, it adopted a surprise torpedo attack against all enemy surface vessels, torpedoing without warning even fishing vessels. And I've actually got American war propaganda films where they are showing you through the periscope sinking of Japanese shipping vessels, fishing vessels, and torpedoing it. And I remember looking at that before I even knew about this, thinking, that's pretty bad. Why would you sink a fishing vessel? What military significance is that? Similarly, what the American government condemned as a war crime, Japan bombing the Chinese city of Shanghai, which certainly was a war crime, the US Air Force undertook as a matter of policy bombing the cities of Germany in so-called strategic bombing offensives and saturation bombing campaigns. So there's double standards here. The British Navy's hunger blockade of Germany continued for 4 months after the World War I had ended, on 11th of November 1918. Hundreds of thousands of non-combatants perished from cold and hunger because of the blockade during the winter following the armistice. 4 months after the war ended, people were dying by the tens and hundreds of thousands. Now, it's been pointed out that the Congress of Vienna, 1814 to 1815, which concluded 25 years of the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars, produced a peace settlement that endured for a full century. That's pretty impressive. From 1815 to 1914, Europe was at peace in the West, most as far as general wars goes. But the Congress of Vienna was worked out by European powers without any American assistance. However, the Versailles Treaty, with the meddling of the American President Woodrow Wilson, who claimed to want to make the world safe for democracy, spectacularly failed. It's got to be the worst peace treaty in the history of the world. The punitive and vindictive Versailles Treaty guaranteed an even more terrible conflict would erupt 2 decades later, leading to deaths of tens of millions more people and a massive expansion of communist control over Eastern and Central Europe. The sinking of the Lusitania provides another tragic example of the deadly consequences of deception and propaganda. Propaganda kills. As the militaries were locked in a stalemate in the Western Front, the propaganda war became decisive because you couldn't win. It didn't matter what happened, you could gain 3-4 trenches. But there were more. There was defense in depth from both sides. So it didn't matter how much you gained, you would stop. And an enemy would counterattack. And you would lose just about everything. The line did not move much in over 3 years. One of the first rules that Masterman enforced on British reporters was that there's to be absolutely no photographs published of the war except those taken by official photographers appointed by the Propaganda Bureau. There were to be no pictures of dead soldiers published, and no cameras were allowed. Realizing that unrestricted photography of the war could be very dangerous to civilian morale, the prohibition of cameras was very seriously enforced. No officer or soldier was permitted to be in possession of a camera. Technically, owning and using a camera in operation area could be punishable by death by firing squad. However, as anyone who's visited World War I museums such as Hill 60 near Ypres can see, hundreds of contemporary photographs which British soldiers risked taking and that survived the war. In 1916, Masterman recruited a talented artist, Muirhead Bone, to paint more idealized depictions of war. Art is so much better than photography because you don't have to be restrained by what actually happened. You can present some idealized picture of it. And these pencil and charcoal sketches were so successful that 90 war artists were employed, including William Offren and William Rothstein, and you could have victories that never even occurred. The most memorable propaganda image from World War I was that of General Kitchener, the same Kitchener who had the concentration camps in South Africa during the Anglo-Boer War. Your country wants you, or your country needs you. And these posters actually were very ineffective. Voluntary recruitment fell so far below the replacement levels needed for 1915 that the British government was obliged to introduce conscription, which they never wanted to do. The primary target for British propaganda, the United States, was successfully recruited to join the Allied war effort. In fact, so effective was the British propaganda in America that when the US government declared war on Germany, the general perception amongst Americans was that America only needed to provide food, weapons and ammunition for the already victorious English, French and Russian armies. It came as a shock to the Senate majority Democratic leader that the US would have to send an army to Europe. Thomas Fleming observed, leading newspapers such as the New York Tribune and the Los Angeles Times assured their leaders that no American army was needed in Europe. Everyone thought the war was as good as won. I mean, if you believe the propaganda. All of virtually victorious English, French, and Russians need from the United States was large amounts of food, weapons, and ammunition paid for by American loans. Fleming attributes a state of ignorance on the effectiveness of the British War Propaganda Bureau. With the cutting of the German telegraph cables and effective censorship, American newsmen only knew of the war from the English and the French side. As early as 1916, a U.S. congressman had inserted into the congressional record a complaint that America had been deluged with stories puffing British and French battlefield superiority, and speakers by the hundreds toured America telling the same lie. And that's from a U.S. congressman in the congressional record. British propaganda sought to seize the moral high ground by accusing the German army of atrocious behavior. Although Belgium had military alliances with France and Britain, and had had from the beginning, the Germans were accused of violating Belgian neutrality, which never existed. There was no Belgian neutrality. It was an ally of France, always. Germany pointed out that Belgium chose to put itself on the side of France, and Belgium was one great fortified camp against Germany. In fact, the French and British military had begun pouring into Belgium 30th of July, several days before Germany responded and before wars had been declared. There could have been no one in Britain and very few in the United States who did not hear or read of the British Propaganda Bureau's fabrications of German soldiers killing women and children indiscriminately, raping nuns, cutting off the hands and feet of children, bayoneting babies. Everyone heard that. The fact is the German army was the most disciplined army in the world. And despite many challenges, including from the American lawyer Clarence Darrow, who offered $1,000 cash to anyone who could substantiate just one of these atrocities, not one document case could ever be shown. Yet the Propaganda Bureau processed these urban myths into permanent historical fact by one of the most sophisticated, ruthless propaganda machines ever assembled, and I'll give examples of what actually happened in the war next week. But let's conclude with something that cuts right across all this propaganda nonsense. The first Christmas, 1914, on the Western Front has been immortalized in a film, Joyeux Noël, Merry Christmas, on the true story of what happened across the entire Western Front, all the way from Belgium through to the Swiss border. The German soldiers were singing Silent Night, the British trenches responded, and it spread. German soldiers came across sharing their Christmas trees with the Allies, and a truce was held. No fighting took place across the whole Western Front, Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. And it's something that shook the high commands on all sides, but it actually happened. And here's an actual picture of German and British troops intermingled on Christmas Day. And it's this sort of thing that got cameras banned on the front line. When I went to Ypres recently, I saw a memorial from the Australians set up in memory of the football match they held on Christmas Day and the sharing of ration packs. And here you can see, if you've seen the film, Joyeux Noël, is one of the descendants of Felix, the cat coming out as well. Lest we forget, 85 years later, some of the actual participants put up this memorial. And it happened. And on both sides, they saw the men on the other side are also Christians. Well, there's a lot that we can read on where the war began, who started it. The title for tonight I took from a very outstanding book called Best of Enemies, Britain and Germany, Truths and Lies in Two World Wars. And there's a lot of good material in there. On the Lusitania, there's a lot of books that have come out exposing it, and we need to understand about guilt manipulation too. So, any comments, any questions at all? Yes?
Do you think that the war caused the decline of Christianity in Europe? Do the churches mean
so? No. The war the war was not caused by decline of church attendance, because church attendance was very high. The war caused a decline of war attendance afterwards. Is that what you meant? Yes. The war, because people were shattered. Their faith was shattered. That Christian nations could have gone to war, and they didn't understand what was behind it. And we're going to look at the role of the bankers and the role of the media, who actually connived, because it did not serve the interest of any of the royal houses of Europe. It didn't serve the interest of the people of Europe. It didn't serve the interest of the armies of Europe. It served the interests of some conniving people who wanted a League of Nations, and of course what led to the United Nations, an International Monetary Fund, and a lot of bankers got very, very, very rich on the First World War. It destroyed generations of Europe. Millions of Europeans died in these wars. We're talking about over 40 million soldiers were killed in battle. That's not counting the ones who died of starvation, just millions more.
It took the cream of, in Europe,
it did.
The youngsters from the West countries used to go into the army. So it actually took the cream of the crop.
It did. Now, I remember at school in Rhodesia, standing in every day that we were in our big hall in Milton High School, we had floor-to-ceiling, you know, these big halls, floor-to-ceiling war memorials with the names on in wood of the men who had died from our school. And I noticed there was a lot more who died in the First World War than the Second World War. And Rhodesia was not a big country. It was not a big country at all. And I've been to churches all over England, and every church has got their memorials and the names from the people of this congregation who died in the First World War. You can't go to any place in the world where British people live and not find a war memorial to the people who died from that community in the First World War. It hits everyone. It's just, and because the units in the First World War were from the same area, you had a case in the First World War of an American family that lost five brothers. They won one battleship. Five. And there were terrible things like that happened. So the faith of the people in Europe, the people that just come out of the greatest century, the 19th century, greatest century of advance, of optimism, of inventions, of progress, of prosperity. The world was at the most dizzying height of inventions and of optimism and of prosperity. There had never been standards of living as high. And the world was being civilized, evangelized, explored, and people were sky high in optimism in 1914. And the next 4 years just shattered that. So as at the end, church attendance took such a wobble, and you will notice that if you've studied the history of the cultures, they went into a really immoral binge in the 1920s. There was the sense of we've survived, and a whole lot had this eat, drink, and be merry mentality. And that's when you started to have the flappers and a lot of tendencies in dance and music was quite immoral. Then there was a reaction. Then the Second World War hit, and after that, Europe became secular. Because one of the problems was, how many of the pastors became mouthpieces for propaganda and God is on our side and the other side are evil and we've got it. And the amount of ministers who encouraged this mindless auto-genocide between brothers, people fighting one another when they're of the same faith and the same clan even, literally cousins. It's outrageous. So I'm not surprised that it shattered. It shattered their faith in the church, it shattered their faith in the governments, and for many of them, it shattered their faith in God. Yes, they had trouble discerning the difference between God and the leaders who claimed to speak for them. And of course they'd been lied to, and I think the people of Europe were so shattered by this experience. And the Second World War, with the bombing of cities, went into even worse level. In the First World War, more soldiers died. In the Second World War, more civilians died. But both of them were catastrophes of such a... I would say the First World War was worse than the Second, in the sense that it was the end of the Christian era. And that's why I believe there were very evil anti-Christian elements who connived to get Christian Europe to fight one another. Nobody at that time could have thought of communism as a threat, because communism didn't control any territory. Not in 1914. They wouldn't think of Islam as a threat. Ottoman Empire was dying and decaying. Islam was backwater. And to think that they saw fellow Christians as their enemies. But the strange thing was that in the First World War, you didn't have Protestants fighting Catholics. Yet Protestant Germans and Catholic Austrians against Orthodox Russians, Catholic and humanist French and Protestant English, and then Protestant Americans and South Africa. Why were we across lines fighting against our own people? It was very, very strangely organized. And if you think of it from the point of hell, how could the Christian advance of the 19th century be stopped any other way? How did a Christian world become a secular world? The First and Second World War was absolutely essential to turn a Christian world into a secular world.
I think that the main cause of falling away of communism. Because in a way, usually adversity strengthens Christianity, but then peace is good for...
Yes, you could say that, but it didn't just get rid of the nominals. It removed the opportunity for the next generation to be raised in faith. And amongst them, they didn't even have the choice. So what you've got is, as a result of the First World War and then the Second, the Christian educational system of Europe got removed and replaced with secular education. And it's that everything that is evil in the world today, I would say, starts from 1914, at least in its public application. Because what is the curse of today? Lies in the media. Where did that come from? Right back there. The church in retreat. Again, nobody in 1914 doubted that the church was to disciple and evangelize the whole world and bring the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life, that God's law applies to everything. They didn't doubt that. But the people, you could accuse them of being naive. They didn't perceive the threat. Because how could there be a threat? The greatest nations on earth, the greatest militaries are Christian. Industries in the hands of the Christian church, what is there to fear? Who could... Muslims couldn't threaten us. These few revolutionaries, what could they do? The only way that Christian Europe could be destroyed was to get Christian Europe to destroy themselves. To get them to fight one another. And then they hated their own heritage, hated their own country, hated their own faith. And after a while, didn't even have a sense of belonging to their own family. I mean, I just think, for example, my own mother. She's brought up in the faith. Her family is Lutheran. But when she left Europe, she never wanted to go back. She never went back. She left off the Second World War. She didn't want to see it. All Europe held for her was horror and terror, bombing of cities, home lost, everything destroyed, everything looted, thrown into the snow, had to walk with what they had, saw the soldiers carrying everything to the top and smashing all of their cutlery, lifting up the Grand Pioneer, smashing it all, just taking over their home as an officer's mess, and you're out in the snow in the middle of winter. And to her, she came to Africa to get away from that, and she never wanted to go back. And that's the attitude of a lot of people. To them, that was it. Two world wars, enough. And people gave up on just about everything. And that you go to Europe now, and what do you see? There's no sense of identity in anything. And what's happening? The Muslims are hijacking. You couldn't have imagined that in 1940, that Europe could be hijacked by Muslims or communists. Wouldn't have even been possible. Yeah, legalized pornography, legalized abortion, unthinkable. Nobody, you would have been thought a nutcase if you suggested that in 1914. 1914, you had a Christian world who was tricked into fighting one another, and they did it with enthusiasm. There's never been such efficient killing of people in such huge magnitudes. Here you had all this industry and all this work ethic channeled in the most unconstructive direction. So, I don't think there's a close second. I'd say the First World War was the worst event in the history of civilization, the worst event in the history of the church. It's what got the missionary enterprise off track. All of our problems, I'd say, date back to that. And from a personal application, it should teach us we should not fight one another. Mm. On a personal level, it's not worth fighting fellow brothers, ever. Doesn't matter what the problem is in your family or with fellow Christians, there's a better way. You don't have to go to war. Next week I want to get in. Now, first of all, we'll take more than 2 weeks, but we're going to try and get into it, and then it'll take quite a few sessions to really do justice. I think here we've laid into what led into the propaganda side, but even this is only the first half, because this is how far I got, and I think this is as much as anyone can take in one evening.